but he didn't have enough solicitude to waste on monkeys at the moment. Thank you for your help. Perhaps someone will be back to speak to you. I regret that I could not tell you more. He was sincere enough about it. For $5,000 in cash, he thought he should do more. Not that he'd return any, of course. The two men walked back toward the car. Chavez joined up, looking pensive, but not saying anything. As they approached, the cop and the attaché shook hands. Then it was time for the Americans to leave. As the car pulled off, John looked back to see the dealer take the envelope from his pocket and extract a few bills to hand over to the friendly chief constable. That made sense, too.
"What did you learn?" the real colonel asked.
"No records," John replied.
"It's the way they do business here. There's an export fee for those things, but the cops and the customs people usually have an
arrangement," John interrupted with a frown.
"That's the word. Hey, my father came from Mississippi. They used to say down there that one term as county sheriff fixed a guy up for life, you know."
"Cages," Ding said suddenly.
"Huh?" Clark asked.
"Didn't you see, John, the cages? We seen 'em before, just like those in Tehran, in the Air Force hangar."
He'd kept his distance in order to duplicate what he'd seen at Mehrabad. The relative size and proportions were the same.
"Chicken coops or cages or whatever in a hangar with fighter planes, remember?"
"Shit!"
"One more indicator, Mr. C. Them coincidences are piling up, Mano.
Where are we going next?"
"Khartoum."
"I saw the movie."
News coverage continued, but little else. Every network affiliate became more important as the name correspondents were trapped in their base offices of New York, Washington, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and the news devoted a great deal of time to visuals of National Guardsmen on the major interstate highways, blocking the roads physically with Hummers or medium trucks. No one really tried to run the blockades there. Food and medical supply trucks were allowed through, after each was inspected, and in a day or two the drivers would be tested for Ebola antibodies, and given picture passes to make their way more efficiently. The truckers were playing ball. It was different for other vehicles and other roads. Though most interstate highway traffic went on the major highways, there was not a state in the Union that didn't have an extensive network of side roads that interconnected with those of neighboring states, and all of these had to be blocked, too. That took time to accomplish, and there were interviews of people who'd gotten across and thought it something of a joke, followed by learned commentary that this proved that the president's order was impossible to implement completely, in addition to being wrong, stupid, and unconstitutional.
"It just isn't possible," one transportation expert said on the morning news.
But that hadn't accounted for the fact that National Guardsmen lived in the country they guarded and could read maps. They were also offended by the implied statement that they were fools. By noon on Wednesday there was a vehicle on every country road, crewed by men with rifles and wearing the chemical protective suits that made them look like men, and women, though that was almost impossible to tell, from Mars. On the side roads, if not the main ones, there were clashes. Some were mere words. "My family is right over there. Give a guy a break, okay?" Sometimes the rule was enforced with a little common sense, after an identification check and a radio call. In other cases, the enforcement was literal, and here and there words were exchanged, some of them heated, and some of those escalated, and in two cases shots were fired, and in one of them a man was killed. Reported rapidly up the line, it was national news in 2 hours, and again commentators wondered at the wisdom of the president's order. One of them laid the death on the front steps of the White House. For the most part, even those most determined to make their way to their cross-border destinations saw the uniformed men with guns and decided that it wasn't worth the risk. The same applied to international borders. The Canadian military and police closed all border crossing points. American citizens in Canada were asked to report to the nearest hospital for testing, and there they were detained in a civilized way. Something similar happened in Europe, though there the treatment differed from one country to another. For the first time, it was the Mexican army which closed America's southern border in cooperation with U.S. authorities, this time against traffic mainly moving south. Some local traffic was moving. Supermarkets and convenience stores allowed people in, mainly in small numbers, to purchase necessities. Pharmacies sold out of surgical masks. Many called local hardware and paint dealers to get protective masks made for other uses. And TV coverage helped there by telling people that such masks, sprayed with common household disinfectants, offered better protection against a virus than the Army's chemical gear. But inevitably, some people overdid the spraying, and that resulted in allergic reactions, respiratory difficulties, and a few deaths. Physicians all across the country were frantically busy. It was rapidly known that the initial presentation of Ebola was similar to flu symptoms, and any doctor could relate that people could think themselves into those. Telling the truly sick from the hypochondriac was rapidly becoming the most demanding of medical skills. Despite it all, however, people dealt with it, watched their televisions, looked at one another, and wondered how much substance there was to the scare. That was the job of CDC and USAMRID, aided by the FBI. There were now 500 confirmed cases, each of which had been tied directly or indirectly to 18 trade shows. That gave them time references. It also identified 4 other trade shows from which no illnesses had as yet developed. All 22 had been visited by agents, all of whom learned that in every case the rubbish from the shows had long since been hauled off. There was some thought that the trash might be picked through, but USAMRID waved the bureau off and said that identifying the distribution system would mean comparing the contents of thousands of tons of material, a task that simply was not possible and might even be dangerous. The important discovery was the time window. That information was made public at once. Americans who had traveled out of the country prior to the start dates of the trade shows that were known to have been focal centers were not dangerous. That fact was made known to National Health Services worldwide, most of which tacked on from 2 days to a full week. From them, the information became global knowledge within a few hours. There was no stopping it, and there was no purpose in keeping the secret, even if it were possible to do so. "Well, that means we're all safe," General Diggs told his staff at the morning conference. Fort Irwin was one of the most isolated encampments in America. There was only one way in and out, and that road was now blocked by a Bradley. That wasn't true of other military bases. The problem was global. A senior Army officer from the Pentagon had flown to Germany to hold a conference with 5th Corps headquarters, and 2 days later collapsed, in the process infecting a doctor and 2 nurses. The news had shaken NATO allies, who instantly quarantined American encampments that dated back to the 1940s. The news was also instantly on global TV. What was worse in the Pentagon was that nearly every base had a case, real or suspected. The effect on unit morale was horrific, and that information also was impossible to conceal. Transatlantic phone lines burned with worry headed in both directions. Things were frantic in Washington, too. The joint task force included members of all the intelligence services, plus FBI and the federal law enforcement establishment. The president had given them a lot of power to use, and they intended to use it. The manifest of the lost Gulfstream business jet had started things moving in a new and unexpected direction, but that was the way of investigations. In Savannah, Georgia, an FBI agent knocked on the door of the president of Gulfstream and handed him a surgical mask. The factory was shut down, as were most American businesses, but that executive order would be bent today. The president called his chief safety officer and told him to head in, along with the firm's senior test pilot. 6 FBI agents sat down with them for a lengthy chat that soon evolved into a conference call. The most important immediate result was the discovery that the lost aircraft's flight recorder hadn't been recovered. That resulted in a call to the CEO of USS Radford, who confirmed that his ship, now in dry dock, had tracked the lost aircraft and then had searched for the sonar pings of the black box, but to no avail. The naval officer could not explain that. Gulfstream's chief test pilot explained that if the aircraft hit hard enough, the instrument could break despite its robust design. But it hadn't been going all that fast, the Radford skipper remembered, and no debris had been found either. As a result of that, the FAA and NTSB were called in and told to produce records instantly. In Washington, the working group was in the FBI building. Looks were exchanged over the masks everyone was wearing. The FAA part of the team had run down the identity of the flight crew and their qualifications. It turned out that they were both former Iranian Air Force pilots trained in America in the late 1970s. From that came photos and fingerprints. Another pair of pilots, flying the same sort of aircraft for the same Swiss corporation, had similar training, and the FBI's legal attaché in Bern made an immediate call to his Swiss colleagues to request assistance in interviewing them. "Okay," Dan Murray summarized. "We got a sick Belgian nun and a friend with an Iranian doctor. They fly off in a Swiss-registered airplane that disappears without a trace. The airplane belongs to a little trading company. The legout will run that down for us pretty fast, but we know the flight crew was Iranian."
"It does seem to be heading in a certain direction, Dan," Ed Foley said.
Just then an agent came in with a fax for the CIA director.
"Check this out."
He slid it across the table. It wasn't a long message.
"People think they're so fucking smart," Murray told the people around the table. He passed the new dispatch around.
"Don't underestimate 'em," Ed Foley warned.
"We don't have anything hard yet. The president can't take any action at all on anything until we do."
"And maybe not even then," his mind went on, "as gutted as the military is right now."
There was also the thing Chavez had said before flying off. Damn, but that kid was getting smart. Foley wondered whether to bring that up. There were more pressing matters for now, he decided. He could discuss it with Murray privately.
Chavez didn't feel smart as he dozed in his leather seat. It was another 3-hour hop to Khartoum, and he was having dreams, fitful ones.
He'd done his share of flying as a CIA officer, but even on a plush executive jet with all the bells and whistles, you got tired of it in a hurry. The diminished air pressure meant diminished oxygen, and that made you tired. The air was dry, and that dehydrated you. The noise of the engines made it like sleeping out in the boonies with insects swarming around all the time, always ready to suck your blood, and you could never make the little bastards go away. Whoever was doing whatever was happening wasn't all that smart. Okay, an airplane had disappeared with 5 people aboard, but that wasn't necessarily a dead end, was it? HXNJA, he remembered from the customs document. They'd probably kept records because they were shipping out people rather than monkeys. HX for Switzerland. Why HX, he wondered. H for Helvetia, maybe? Wasn't that an old name for Switzerland? Didn't some languages still call it that? He seemed to remember that some did. German, maybe. NJA to identify the individual aircraft. They used letters instead of numbers because it made for more permutations. Even this one had such a code, with an N prefix, because American aircraft used that letter code. NJA, he thought with his eyes closed. NJA. Ninja. That generated a smile. The sobriquet for his old outfit, 1st Battalion of the 17th Infantry Regiment.
We own the night. Yeah, those were the days, humping the hills at Fort Ord and Hunter Liggett. But the 7th Infantry Division, Light, had been de-established, its standards furled and cased for retirement, or maybe later use. Ninja. That seemed important. Why? His eyes opened. Chavez stood, stretched, and went forward. There he woke the pilot with whom Clark had had that little tiff.
Colonel?
What is it? Only one eye opened.
What's one of these things cost?
More than either one of us can afford. The eye closed back down.
Seriously?
Upwards of $20 million, depending on the version and the avionics package. If somebody makes a better business jet, I don't know what it is.
Thanks.
Chavez returned to his seat. There was no sense in trying to fade back out. He felt the nose lower and heard the engines reduce their annoying sound. They were starting their descent into Khartoum. The local CIA station chief would be meeting, excuse me, he thought to himself, commercial attaché. Or was it political officer? Whatever. He knew that this city wouldn't be as friendly as the last two. The helicopter landed at Fort McHenry, close to the statue of Orpheus that someone had decided was appropriate to honor the name of Francis Scott Key, Ryan noted irrelevantly. About as irrelevant as Arnie's idea for a fucking photo opportunity. He had to show he was concerned. Jack wondered about that. Did people think that at times like this the president threw a party? Hadn't Poe written a story like that? The Mask of the Red Death? Something like that. But that plague had gotten into the party, hadn't it? The president rubbed his face. Sleep, have to sleep, thinking crazy shit. It was like flashbulbs. Your mind got tired and random thoughts blinked into your mind for no apparent reason, and then you had to fight them back and get your mind going on the important stuff. The usual Chevy Suburbans were there, but not the presidential limo. Ryan would ride in the obviously armored vehicle. There were cops around, too, looking grim. Well, everybody else did, too. Why not them? He, too, was wearing a mask, and there were 3 TV cameras to record the fact. Maybe it was going out live. He didn't know, and scarcely looked at the cameras on the short walk to the cars. They started moving almost at once, up Fort Avenue, then north onto Key Highway. It was 10 fast minutes over vacated city streets, heading toward Johns Hopkins, where the President and First Lady would show how concerned they were for other cameras. A leadership function, Arnie had told him, picking a phrase he was sure to recognize as something he had to respect, whether he liked it or not. And the hell of it was, Arnie was right. He was the president, and he couldn't isolate himself from the people. Whether he could do anything substantive to help them or not, they had to see him being concerned. It was something that did and didn't make sense all at the same time. The motorcade pulled into the Wolf Street entrance. There were soldiers there, guardsmen of the 175th Infantry Regiment, the Maryland Line. The local commander had decided that all hospitals had to be guarded, and Ryan supposed that was one of the things that did make sense. The detail was nervous to have men around with loaded rifles, but they were soldiers, and that was that. Disarming them might have made the news, after all. They all saluted, masked as they were in their mop gear, rifles slung over their shoulders. Nobody had threatened the hospital. Perhaps they were the reason why. Or maybe it was just that people were scared. Enough that one cop had remarked to a service agent that street crime had dropped to almost nil. Even the drug dealers were nowhere to be seen. There were not very many people to be seen anywhere at this hour, but all of them were masked, and even the lobby was heavy with the chemical smell that was now the national scent. How much of that was a necessary physical measure, and how much psychological, Jack wondered. But then, that's what his trip was.
"Hi, Dave," the president said to the dean. He was wearing greens instead of his suit, masked like everyone else, and gloved, too. They didn't shake hands. "Mr. President, thank you for coming." There were cameras in the lobby. They'd followed him in from outside. Before any of the reporters could shout a request for a statement, Jack pointed, and the dean led the party off. Ryan supposed it would look businesslike. Secret Service agents hustled to get ahead as they walked from the elevator bank to the medical floor. The doors slid open to reveal a busy corridor. Here there was bustle and people. "What's the score, Dave?"
"We have 34 patients admitted here. Total for the area is 140.
"Well, was last time I checked.
We have all the space we need for now, and all the staff, too.
We've released about half of our patients, the ones we could sign out safely. All elective procedures are canceled for now, but there is the usual activity. I mean, babies are being born. People get sick from the normal diseases. Some outpatient treatments have to be continued, epidemic or not."
"Where's Kathy?" Ryan asked, as the next elevator arrived with a single camera, whose tape would be pooled with all the networks. The hospital didn't want or need to be crowded with extraneous people, and while media management people had made a little noise, their field personnel weren't all that eager either. Maybe it was the antiseptic smell. Maybe it affected people the same way it affected dogs taken to the vet. It was the smell of danger for everyone.
"This way. Let's get you suited up."
The floor had a doctor's lounge and one for nurses. Both were being used. The one at the far end was hot, used for disrobing and decontamination. The near one was supposed to be safe, used for suiting up. There wasn't time or space for all the niceties. The Secret Service agents went in first and saw a woman in bra and panties, picking a plastic suit that was her size. She didn't blush. It was her fourth shift on the unit, and she was beyond that.
"Hang your clothes over there," she pointed.
"Oh," she added, recognizing the president.
"Thank you," Ryan said, taking his shoes off and taking a clothes hanger from Andrea. Price examined the woman briefly. Clearly, she wasn't carrying a weapon.
"How is it?" Jack asked.
She was the charge nurse for the floor. She didn't turn to answer.
"Pretty bad."
She paused for a second and then decided she had to turn.
"We appreciate the fact that your wife is up here with us."
"I tried to talk her out of it," he admitted to her.
He didn't feel the least bit guilty about it either and wondered if he should or not.
"So'd my husband."
She came over.
"Here, the helmet goes on like this."
Ryan experienced a brief moment of panic. It was a most unnatural act to put a plastic bag over one's head. The nurse read his face.
"Me too. You get used to it."
Across the room, Dean James was already in his. He also came over to check the president's protective gear.
"Can you hear me?"
"Yeah." Jack was sweating now, despite the portable air conditioning pack that hooked on his belt. The dean turned to the Secret Service personnel. "From here on, I'm the boss," he told them. "I won't let him get into any danger, but we don't have enough suits for you people. If you stay in the corridors, you'll be safe. Don't touch anything. Not the walls, not the floors, nothing. Somebody goes past you with a cart, get out of the way. If you can't get out of the way, walk to the end of the corridor. If you see any kind of plastic container, stay clear of it. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
For once, Andrea Price was cowed, POTUS saw, as was he. The psychological impact of this was horrific. Dr. James tapped the president on the shoulder.
"Follow me. I know it's scary, but you are safe in this thing. We all had to get used to it, too, didn't we, Tisha?"
The nurse turned, now fully in hers.
"Yes, doctor."
"You could hear your breathing. There was the whir of the AC pack, but everything else was muted. Ryan felt a frightening sense of confinement as he walked behind the dean.
"Kathy's in here."
He opened the door. Ryan entered. It was a child. A boy, aged 8 or so, Jack saw. 2 blue-clad figures were ministering to him. From behind, he couldn't tell which one was his wife. Dr. James held his hand up, forbidding Ryan from taking another step.
One of the two was trying to restart an IV, and there couldn't be any distractions. The child was moaning, writhing on the bed. Ryan couldn't see much of him, but he saw enough for his stomach to turn.
"Hold still now. This will make you feel better."
It was Kathy's voice. Evidently she was doing the stick. The other two hands were holding the arm in place.
"There.
Tape," she added, lifting her hands.
"Good stick, doctor."
"Thank you." Kathy went to the electronic box that controlled the morphine and pushed in the right numbers, checking to be sure that the machine started functioning properly. With that done, she turned.
"Oh.
Hi, honey."
"Jack, you don't belong here," Surgeon told him firmly.
"Who does?"
"Okay, I have a line on this Dr. McGregor," the station chief told them, driving his red Chevy. His name was Frank Clayton, a graduate of Grambling, whom Clark had seen through the farm some years earlier.
"Then let's go see him, Frank."
Clark checked his watch, did the calculations, and decided that it was 2 hours after midnight. He grunted.
"Yeah, that was about right."
First stop was the embassy, where they changed clothes. American military uniforms weren't all that welcome here. In fact, the station chief warned, few things American were. Chavez noted that a car followed them in from the airport.
"Don't sweat it. We'll lose him at the embassy. You know, sometimes I wonder if it wasn't a good deal when my folks got kidnapped out of Africa. I don't tell anybody I said that, okay? South Alabama is like heaven on earth compared to this shithole."
He parked the car in the embassy's back lot and took them inside. A minute later, one of his people walked out, started the Chevy, and headed right back out. The tail car went with him.
"Shirts," the CIA resident officer said, handing them over. "I suppose you can leave the pants on."
"Have you talked with McGregor?" Clark asked.
"On the phone a few hours ago. We're going to drive over to where he lives, and he's going to get into the car. I have a nice quiet parking spot picked out for our chat," Clayton told them.
"Any danger to him?"
"I doubt it. The locals are pretty sloppy. If we have anybody tailing us, I know what to do about it."
"Then let's move, buddy," John said. "We're burning moonlight."
McGregor's quarters weren't all that bad, located in a district favored by Europeans, and, the station chief related, fairly secure. He lifted his cellular phone and dialed the doctor's beeper number. There was a local paging service. Less than a minute later, his door opened, and a figure walked to the car, got in the back, and closed the door a second before it moved off.
"This is rather unusual for me."
He was younger than Chavez, John was surprised to note, and eager in rather a shy way.
"Who exactly are you, chaps?"
"CIA," Clark told him.
"Indeed?" "Indeed, doctor,"
Clayton said from the front seat. His eyes checked the mirrors. They were clear. Just to make sure, he took the next left, then a right, and then another left.
"Good."
"Are you allowed to tell people that?" McGregor asked as the car pulled back onto what passed locally as the main drag.
"Do you have to kill me now?"
"Doc, save that for the movies, okay?" Chavez suggested. "Real life ain't like that, and if we told you we were from the State Department, you wouldn't believe us anyway, right?"
"You don't look like diplomats," McGregor decided. Clark turned in the front seat.
"Sir, thank you for agreeing to meet with us."
"The only reason I did so... well, the local government forced me to disregard normal procedures for my two cases. There's a reason for those procedures, you know."
"Okay, first of all, could you please tell me all you can about them?" John asked, switching on the tape recorder.
"You look tired, Kathy."
Not that it was all that easy to tell through the plastic mask. Even her body language was disguised.
Surgeon looked over to the wall clock behind the nursing station. She was technically off duty now. She would never learn that Arnie Van Dam had called the hospital to make sure the timing went right for this. It would have enraged her, and she was mad enough at the whole world already.
"The kids started arriving this afternoon. Second-generation cases. That one in there must have got it from his father. His name is Timothy. He's in the third grade. His dad's on the next floor up.
Rest of the family?
His mom tested positive. They're admitting her now. He has a big sister. She's clean so far. We have her sitting over in the outpatient building. They set up a holding area there for people who've been exposed but don't test out. Come on, I'll show you around the floor. A minute later, they were in room one, temporary home of the index case. Ryan thought he must be imagining the smell. There was a dark stain on the bedclothes which two people, nurses, doctors, he couldn't tell, were struggling to change. The man was semi-conscious and fighting the restraints that held his arms to the bed bars. That had the two medics concerned, but they had to change the sheets first. Those went into a plastic bag. "They'll get burned," Kathy said, pressing her helmet against her husband's. "We've really dialed up the safety precautions." "How bad?" She pointed back to the door and followed Jack into the corridor. Once there, with the door closed behind them, she poked an angry finger into his chest. "Jack, you never, ever discuss a patient's prognosis in front of them, unless you know it's good. Never." She paused and went on without an apology for the outburst. "He's 3 days into frank symptoms. Any chance?" Her head shook inside the helmet. They walked back up the corridor, stopping in some more rooms where the story was dismally the same. "Kathy," it was the dean's voice, "you're off duty. Move," he commanded. "Where's Alexander?" Jack asked, on the way to the former physician's lounge. "He's got the floor upstairs. Dave has taken this one himself. We hoped Ralph Forster would get back and help out, but there aren't any flights." Then she saw the cameras. "What the hell are they doing here?"
"Come on."
Ryan led his wife into the changing room. The clothing he'd worn to the hospital was bagged somewhere. He put on scrubs in front of three women and a man who didn't seem all that interested in ogling any of the females. Leaving the room, he headed for the elevator. "Stop," a female voice called. "There's a case coming up from ER. Use the stairs." And, obediently, the Secret Service detail did just that. Ryan led his wife down to the main floor, and from there out front, still wearing masks. "How are you holding up?" Before she could answer, a voice screamed, "Mr. President!" Two guardsmen got in the way of the reporter and cameraman, but Ryan waved them off. The pair approached under armed scrutiny, uniformed and plain clothes. "Yes, what is it?" Ryan asked, pulling his mask down. The reporter held the microphone at full arm's length. It would have been comical under other circumstances. Everybody was spooked.
"What are you doing here, sir?"
"Well, I guess it's part of my job to see what's going on. And also I wanted to see how Kathy is doing."
"We know the First Lady is working upstairs. Are you trying to make a statement to the nation?"
"I'm a doctor," Kathy snapped. "We're all taking turns up there. It's my job."
"Is it bad?"
Ryan spoke before she could explode at them. "Look, I know you have to ask that question, but you know the answer. These people are extremely ill, and the docs here and every place else are doing their best. It's hard on Kathy and her colleagues. It's really hard on the patients and their families."
"Dr. Ryan, is Ebola really as deadly as everyone has been saying?"
She nodded.
"It's pretty awful, yes. But we're giving these people the best we got.
Some have suggested that since the hope for the patients is so bleak, and since their pain is so extreme..."
"What are you saying? Kill them?"
"What if they're really suffering as much as everyone reports?"
"I'm not that kind of doctor," she replied, her face flushed.
"We're going to save some of these people. From those we save, maybe we can learn to save more. And you don't learn anything by giving up. That's why real doctors don't kill patients."
"What is the matter with you? Those are people in there, and my job is fighting for their lives. And don't you dare tell me how to do it."
She stopped when her husband's arm squeezed her shoulder.
"Sorry, it's a little tough in there."
"Could you excuse us for a few minutes?" Ryan asked. "We haven't talked since yesterday. You know, we are husband and wife, just like real people."
"Yes, sir."
They pulled back, but the camera stayed on them.
Come here, babe.
Jack embraced her for the first time in more than a day.
We're going to lose them all, Jack.
Everyone starting tomorrow or the next day, she whispered. Then she started crying.
Yeah.
He lowered his head on hers.
You know, you're allowed to be human too, Doctor.
How do they think we learned anything?
Oh, we can't fix it, so let them all die with dignity.
Give up. That's not what they taught me here.
I know.
She sniffed and wiped her eyes on his shirt.
Okay, back under control now.
I'm off duty for 8 hours.
Where are you sleeping?
A deep breath, a shudder.
Mommy. They have some cots set up. Bernie's up in New York, helping out at Columbia. They have a couple hundred cases there.
You're pretty tough, Doctor. He smiled down at his wife.
Jack, if you find out who did this to us...
Working on it, POTUS said.
Know any of these people?
The station chief handed over some photos he'd shot himself. He handed over a flashlight, too.
That's Sally. Who was he exactly? He didn't say, and I never found out.
These are all Iraqis. When the government came down, they flew here. I have a bunch of photos.
You're sure of this one?
Quite sure. I treated him for over a week. The poor chap died.
MacGregor went through some more.
And that looks like Sohaila. She survived, thank God. Lovely child. And that's her father.
What the hell? Chavez asked.
Nobody told us that.
We were at the farm then, weren't we?
Back to being a training officer, John, Frank Clayton grinned. Well, I got the word, and so I went out to shoot the pictures. They came in first class, by God, a big old G. Here, see?
Clark looked at it and grunted. It was almost a twin to the one they were using for their round-the-world jaunt.
Nice shots.
Thank you, sir.
Let me see that. Chavez took the photo. He held the light right up against it.
Ninja, he whispered. Fucking ninja.
What?
John, read those letters off the tail, Ding said quietly.
HX, NJA.
My God.
Clayton, Chavez said, is that cellular phone secure?
The station chief turned it on and punched in 3 digits.
It is now. Where do you want to call?
Langley.
Mr. President, can we talk to you now?
Jack nodded.
Yeah, sure, come on.
He needed to walk some and waved for them to follow.
Maybe I should apologize for Kathy. She's not like that.
She's a good doc, Swordsman said tiredly. They're all pretty stressed out up there. The first thing they teach 'em here, I think it goes primum non nocere. First of all, do no harm. It's a pretty good rule. Anyway, my wife's had a couple of hard days in there. But so have all of us.
It is possible that this was a deliberate act, sir?
We're not sure. And I can't talk about that until I have good information one way or the other.
You've had a busy time, Mr. President.
The reporter was local, not part of the Washington scene. He didn't know how to talk to a president, or so others might think. Regardless, this one was going out live on NBC, though even the reporter didn't know that.
Yeah, I guess I have.
Sir, can you give us any hope?
Ryan turned at that.
For the people who are sick, well, the hope comes from the docs and the nurses. They're fine people. You can see that here. They're fighters, warriors. I'm very proud of my wife and what she does. I'm proud of her now. I asked her not to do this. I suppose that's selfish of me, but I said it anyway. Some people tried to kill her once before, you know. I don't mind danger to me, but my wife and kids... No, it's not supposed to happen to them. Not supposed to happen to any of these people. But it did, and now we have to do our best to treat the sick ones and make sure people don't get sick unnecessarily.
I know my executive order has upset a lot of people, but I can't live with not doing something that might save lives.
I wish there were an easier way, but if there is, nobody's told me about it yet.
You see, it's not enough to say, no, I don't like that.
Anybody can do that. We need more right now.
Look, I'm pretty tired, he said, looking away from the camera. Can we call it a day for now?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. President.
Sure.
Ryan turned away, walking south, just wandering, really, toward the big parking garages. He saw a man smoking a cigarette there, a black man about 40, in defiance of the signs that prohibited the vice within sight of this shrine of medical learning. POTUS walked up to him, heedless of the three agents and two soldiers behind him.
Got a spare?
Sure.
The man didn't even look up as he sat on the edge of the brick planter looking down at the concrete. His left hand held out the pack and a butane lighter at arm's length. By unspoken consent, they didn't sit close together.
Thanks.
Ryan sat down about 4 feet away from the man, reaching to hand the items back.
You too, man?
What do you mean?
My wife's in there, got the sickness. She worked with the family, nanny-like. They're all sick. Now she is, too. My wife's a doc. She's up there with him. Ain't gonna matter, man. Ain't gonna matter at all.
I know.
Ryan took a long pull and let it out.
Won't even let me in. Say it too dangerous. Taking my blood. Say I gotta stay close. Won't let me smoke. Won't let me see her.
Sweet Jesus, man, how come?
If it was you who was sick, and you knew that you might give it to your wife, what would you do?
He nodded with angry resignation.
I know, the doctor said that. He's right, I know. But that don't make it right.
He paused.
Helps to talk.
Yeah, I guess it does.
The fuckers did this, like they say on TV. Somebody did this. Fuckers gotta pay, man.
Ryan didn't know what to say then. Somebody else did. It was Andrea Price.
Mr. President, I have the DCI for you.
That turned the man's head. He looked at Ryan in the yellow-orange lighting.
You're him?
Yes, sir, Jack answered quietly.
You say your wife is working up there?
A nod. A sigh.
Yeah, she's been working here for 15 years. I came in to see her and see how it is, how it's going. I'm sorry.
What do you mean?
They won't let you in, but they let me in.
He grimaced.
I guess you gotta see, eh? Tough what happened with your little girl last week. She okay?
Yeah, she's fine. At that age, well, you know how it is.
Good. Hey, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for the smoke, the president said, standing and walking to Agent Price. He took the phone.
Ed, it's Jack.
Mr. President, we need you back. We have something you need to see, Ed Foley told him.
He wondered how he would explain that the evidence was hanging on the wall of a conference room in CIA headquarters.
Give me an hour, Ed.
Yes, sir, we are getting it organized now. Jack hit the end switch on the phone and handed it back.
Let's move.
Chapter 53. Sny. Before flying home, everyone had to be decontaminated. Hopkins had set up a large room with separation of the sexes this time. The water was hot and stank of chemicals, but the smell gave Ryan a needed sense of safety. Then he donned a new set of greens. He'd worn them before, when he'd attended the births of his children. Happy connotations. No longer, he thought, as he headed for the Suburban for the drive back to Fort McHenry and the helicopter hop back to the White House. At least the shower had enlivened him. It might even last a few hours, POTUS thought, as the VH-3 lifted off and turned southwest.
if he were lucky.
It was the most lackluster performance in the history of the National Training Center. The troopers of the 11th Cav and the tankers of the Carolina Guard had blundered about for 5 hours, barely executing the plans that both had set up. The replay in the Star Wars room showed cases where tanks had been less than 1,000 meters apart and in plain sight, yet hadn't exchanged fire. Nothing had worked on either side, and the simulated engagement had not so much ended as stopped by apathetic consent. Just before midnight, the units formed up for the drive back to their respective loggers, and the senior commanders went to General Diggs's home on the hill.
"Hi, Nick," Colonel Ham said.
"Hi, Al," Colonel Eddington replied, in about the same tone of voice.
"And what the hell was that all about?" Diggs demanded.
"The men are coming a little unglued, sir," the guardsman replied first. "We're all worried about our people back home. We're safe here. They're in danger there. I can't blame them for being distracted, General. They're human."
"Best thing I can say is that our immediate family seem to be safe here, General," Ham agreed with his older comrade in arms. "But we all got family back in the world."
"Okay, gentlemen, we've all had a chance to cry in our beer. I don't like this shit either, you hear? But your job is to lead your people, and that means lead, goddammit. In case you two warrior chiefs haven't noticed yet, the whole fucking United States Army is tied up in this epidemic. Except us. You two colonels want to think about that? Maybe get your people thinking about it? Nobody ever told me soldiering was an easy job, and damn sure command isn't. But it is the job we do, and if you gentlemen can't get it done, well, there are others who can."
"Sir, that isn't going to work. Ain't nobody to relieve us with," Ham pointed out wryly.
"Colonel?"
"The man's right, Diggs," Eddington said. "Some things are too much.
There's an enemy out there we can't fight. Our people'll come around once they have a chance to get used to it. Maybe get some good news for a change. Come on, General, you know better. You know history. Those are people out there. Yes, soldiers, but people first. They're shook. So am I, Diggs.
I also know that there are no bad regiments, only bad colonels," Diggs retorted, with one of Napoleon's best aphorisms. But he saw that neither man rose to the bait. Jesus, this really was bad.
"How was it?" Van Damme asked.
"Horrible," Ryan replied. "I saw 6 or 7 people who are going to die. One of them's a kid. Kathy says there'll be more of them showing up."
"How's she doing?"
"Pretty stressed, but okay. She really let a reporter have it."
"I know. It was on TV," the chief of staff informed him.
"Already?"
"You were on live."
Arnie managed a smile.
"You look great. Concerned. Sincere as hell. You said nice things about your wife. You even apologized for what she said.
Really good, boss, especially since she looked wonderful. Dedicated. Intense. Just like a doctor is supposed to be."
"Arnie, this isn't theater."
Ryan was too tired to be angry. The reviving effects of the shower, disappointingly, had already worn off.
"No, it's leadership. Some day you're going to learn that."
"Shit, maybe not."
"Just keep going like you're going," Arnie advised.
"You do it without even knowing it, Jack. Don't think about it at all."
NBC shared their tape with the whole world. As competitive as the news business was, a consciousness of public responsibility did pervade the profession, and the tape of the president's brief conversation went out an hour later on television sets across the globe. She'd been right from the first instant, the prime minister told herself. He was far out of his depth. He couldn't even stand up straight. His words rambled. He let his wife speak for him, and she was frantic, emotional, weak. America's time as a major power was ending, because the country lacked firm leadership. She didn't know who had caused this plague to happen, but it was easy to guess. It had to be the UIR.
Why else had he called them together in western China? With her fleet at sea guarding the approaches to the Persian Gulf, she was doing her part. She was sure she would be rewarded for it in due course.
"Your president is distracted," Zhang said. "Understandably so."
"Such a great misfortune. You have our deepest sympathy," the foreign minister added. The three, plus the translator, had also just seen the tape. Adler had been slow in getting the news of the epidemic, but he was up to speed now. He had to set it all aside, however. "Shall we proceed?"
"Does our distant province agree to our compensation demand?" the foreign minister asked.
"Unfortunately not. They take the position that the entire incident results from your extended maneuvers. Viewed abstractly, that point of view is not entirely without merit," the Secretary of State told them in Diplo-speak.
"But the situation is not abstract. We are conducting peaceful exercises. One of their pilots saw fit to attack our aircraft, and in the process, another of their foolish aviators destroyed an airliner. Who is to say if it was an accident or not?"
"Not an accident," Adler asked.
"What possible purpose could there be for such a thing?"
"Who can say with these bandits?" the foreign minister asked in return, stirring the pot a little more.
Ed and Mary Pat Foley came in together. Ed was carrying a large rolled poster or something, Jack saw as he sat in the cabinet room, still wearing greens with Hopkins stenciled on them. Next came Murray, with Inspector O'Day in his wake. Ryan stood to go to him.
"I owe you. Sorry I didn't get to see you sooner." He took the man's hand.
"That was pretty easy compared to this," Pat said. "And my little girl was there, too. But yeah, glad I was there. I won't have any nightmares about that shoot." He turned.
"Oh, hi, Andrea."
Price smiled for the first time that day.
"How's your daughter, Pat?"
"Home with the sitter. They're both okay," he assured her. "Mr. President," it was Goodley, "this is pretty hot."
"Okay, then, shall we get to work? Who starts?"
"I do," the DCI said.
He slid a sheet of paper across the table. "Here." Ryan took it and scanned it. It was some sort of official form, and the words were all in French.
"What's this?"
"It's the immigration and customs clearance form for an airplane. Check the ID box, top left corner."
"HX-NJA.
"Okay, so?" Swordsman asked.
His chief of staff sat at his side, keeping his peace. He felt the tension that the executives had brought into the room. The blow-up of Chavez's photo at Mehrabad Airport was actually larger than a poster, and had been printed up mainly as a joke. Mary Pat unrolled it and laid it flat on the table. Two briefcases were used to keep it from rolling back up.
"Check the tail," the DDO advised.
"HX-NJA.
"I don't have time for Agatha Christie people," the president warned them.
"Mr. President," this was Dan Murray,
"let me walk you through this. But I'll say up front, that photo is something I could take into court and get a conviction with.
The customs form identifies a business jet, a Gulfstream G4 belonging to this Swiss-based corporation." A piece of paper went down on the conference table. "Flown by this flight crew. Two photos and fingerprint cards. It left Zaire with three passengers. Two were nuns, Sister Jean-Baptiste and Sister Maria Magdalena. They were both nurses at a Catholic hospital down there. Sister Jean treated Benedict Macuza, a little boy who contracted Ebola and died of it. Somehow Sister Jean caught it too. And the third passenger, Dr. Mohamed Maoudi, we don't have a photo of him yet, we're working on it, decided to fly the sick one to Paris for treatment. Sister Maria tagged along too. Dr. Maoudi is an Iranian national working with the World Health Organization.
He told the boss nun that she might have a chance there, and said that he could whistle up a private jet to get her there. With me so far? And this is the jet. Correct, Mr. President. This is the jet. Except for one thing. This jet supposedly crashed into the sea after taking off after a refueling stop in Libya. We have a ton of paperwork about that. Except for one thing. He tapped the poster again. That photo was taken by Domingo Chavez. You know him, Mary Pat put in. Go on. When did Ding shoot the frame? Clark and Chavez accompanied Secretary Adler to Tehran just last week. The aircraft was reported lost sometime before that. It was even tracked by one of our destroyers when it squawked emergency. No trace was ever found, however, Murray went on. Ed? When Iraq came apart, Iran allowed the senior military leadership to skip. They all had golden parachutes. Our friend Daryai let them jump out of the airplane. He even provided transport, all right. This started the day after the jet disappeared, Foley told them. They were flown to Khartoum in the Sudan. Our station chief there is Frank Clayton, and he drove to the airport and shot these pictures to confirm our intelligence information. The DCI slid them across. Looks like the same airplane, but what if somebody just played with the numbers, letters, whatever, Ryan asked. Next indicator, Murray said. There were two Ebola cases in Khartoum. Clark and Chavez talked to the attending physician a few hours ago, Mary Pat added. Both the patients flew on this airplane. We have photos of them getting off. So, the FBI director said, now, we have an airplane with a sick person aboard. The airplane disappears. But it turns up less than 24 hours later somewhere else. And two of the passengers come down with the same illness that the nun had. The passengers came from Iraq, via Iran, to the Sudan. Who owns the airplane? Arnie asked. It's a corporation. We should have further details in a few hours from the Swiss. But the flight crew is Iranian. We have info on them because they learned how to fly over here, Murray explained. And finally, we have our friend Daryai here on the same airplane. Looks like it's been taken out of international service. Maybe Daryai is using it to hop around his new country now. So, Mr. President, we have the disease, the airplane, and the owner all tied up. Tomorrow we'll work with Gulfstream to see if the aircraft has any unique characteristics that we can identify in addition to the registration code. We'll have the Swiss pull info on the ownership and the flight logs for the rest of their fleet. We now know who did this, sir, Murray concluded. This chain of evidence is hard to beat. There are more details to flesh out, Mary Pat said. Background on this Dr. Moody, tracking down some monkey shipments. They use monkeys to study the disease. How they staged the faked airplane crash. You believe it, the bastards even made an insurance claim. We're going to suspend this meeting for a moment. Andrea?
Yes, Mr. President.
Get Secretary Brattano and Admiral Jackson in here.
Yes, sir.
She left the room. Ed Foley waited for the door to close behind her. Mr. President?
Yeah, Ed.
There is one other thing. I haven't even told Dan this yet. We now know that the UIR, really our friend Mahmoud Haji Daryai, is behind this. Chavez brought something up before we sent him and John off. The other side could well expect us to trace this back to them. Operational security for something like this is almost impossible to achieve.
So?
So, two things, Jack. First, whatever they're planning, they may think it's irreversible, and therefore it doesn't matter whether we figure this out or not. Second, let's remember how they knocked off Iraq. They got somebody all the way inside. Those were two very big thoughts. Ryan started pondering the first one. Dan Murray's head turned to his roving inspector, and they traded looks on the second.
Christ, Ed, the FBI director said a moment later.
Think it through, Dan, the DCI said. We have a president. We have a Senate. We have a third of the House. We do not have a vice president yet. The presidential succession is still dicey, no really powerful figures, and the top level of the government is still gutted.